I've seen during the week that Kurt Cobain's childhood home is up for sale. The house is 2 hours outside Seattle in Washington State, and there are pictures of the young Kurt in the house, one of them messing around with a guitar. Not surprisingly, the sale has attracted an awful lot of attention. As I've mentioned before as well, this month marks the 20th anniversary of In Utero, which was Nirvana's final studio album. So back in the 90s, grunge was the sound, and Seattle was the city of grunge as well. But apart from that, what more do we know about grunge? I mean, my next guest here now, he's conducted a study of the grunge movement, if I can call it that, by conducting over 250 interviews by the people and the bands most closely associated with this movement, again, if I can call it that. Everybody Loves Our Town, with its ironic title, was clearly a labour of love for Brooklyn-based guitarist Mark Yarm, and he joins me now. Mark, you're very welcome to the programme. Mark, let's get this grunge thing out of the way first. The word grunge, I mean, a lot of so-called grunge acts have a problem with the word grunge, in the same way as punk acts before them had a problem with the word punk. Why did grunge acts have a problem with that actual word grunge?
Well, a lot of them have had a problem with it, rather, because it was a bunch of disparate acts who didn't really sound that much alike and were being labeled. Nobody likes to be labeled, generally speaking. And also it was seen as a marketing term. I think 20-plus years on, a lot of people I interviewed had more of a sense of humor about the term. The sting of it went away. So people are generally a little bit more okay with it now, can see it more as a joke.
Well, like, when it comes to making the scene happen, as one of your contributors says, there was a handful of standout personalities. There was Bruce Pavitt, there was Jonathan Poneman, Susan Silver, Charles R. Peterson. What was it that they all contributed?
Well, in that case, a lot of the the first couple of people you mentioned were the founders of Sub Pop, which was the primary underground label coming out of Seattle at the time. And they were, you know, just instrumental in bringing this, Seattle scene to the rest of the world. There was Charles Peterson, who you mentioned, was the photographer. I mean, everyone who knows about the early Seattle scene has seen his kind of blurred, action-filled pictures. Susan Silver was... she was at one time the manager of Soundgarden and wife to Chris Cornell at the time, and she was very active in promoting these bands. So, I mean, it was a small handful of people outside of the musicians themselves who were revealing this music to the world.
And you make it sound like all these bits and pieces came together to give us a big something. But in one way, nothing really much came together. I mean, let's take a look at Seattle, first of all. Like, I know in terms of its music, you can go back to Jimi Hendrix, etc. But Seattle was never on any kind of rock and roll map. It was a bit of a backwater, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that is actually part of what allowed grunge to form. All these bands, first of all, a lot of touring bands back in the 80s would skip Seattle because it was just too far out of the way and didn't make fiscal sense for them. So they'd skip Seattle, and forcing a lot of the bands in the scene to kind of make their own fun. And also because there was no internet, they weren't being heard outside of the few small clubs they were playing at, gave them a chance to hone their sound. And over period of years, and also to cross-pollinate. So that's something you don't have today with the internet, where you record something today and it's out, that afternoon.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And there's, and regional scenes aren't what they used to be.
Okay, when you say cross-pollination there, I mean, you're talking really about a kind of a suburban metal and a rural punk in some ways that came together in the city. Even Nirvana were way out of the city, and most of these people, just all came together. And by the time they did, and some movement or something seemed to be happening, a lot of the people who were supposedly the main participants were all falling apart, mainly through drugs.
Yeah, they were all falling apart, or they were actually touring, places like Ireland or Europe, or one of the people I spoke to from the Screaming Trees said that mostly he would see all these people from Seattle. He would see them backstage at a festival in Europe somewhere, because it had become this international phenomenon by that point. And the scene itself, it became a little bit more quiet in Seattle itself. And there was a sort of a second generation of bands, and some of whom were actually bands that were moving from LA and elsewhere to try to make it.
And if one band was not going to make it, that band really was Nirvana. They weren't exactly, they didn't come straight out of the trap saying, this is the band that's going to put Seattle on the map.
No, at one point they were sort of second tier on the Sub Pop label. I mean, Mudhoney was always the band that people assumed would sort of break big. I mean, they had their moments, and they're actually still around. Maybe it's best for them that they never did break big because they are still around. But you know, Nirvana was that sort of success was not predicted for them early on. Obviously they defied those early categorizations.
Yeah, but one of the things that does make something famous often is it's made famous somewhere else. As you say, like a lot of these guys were in Europe all the time, and that's where you'd right. find most of them. I mean, for instance, if you think of Blondie and Talking Heads and the Ramones and that, and we would romanticize CBGBs over in this part of the world and say, wow, it must be amazing. And the minute they came over here, we said, God, aren't they fantastic? And that helped them enormously when they went back home and helped them over here as well. Isn't it fair to say that that happens here too? Like, the success in the UK in terms of putting Seattle on the map was huge.
Yeah, I mean, there was a very influential article that the British journalist Everett True wrote for Melody Maker, sort of a encapsulation of the Seattle and Sub Pop and specific scene at that time. Basically, what happened is, you know, Seattle, Sub Pop flew Everett True out, you know, kind of liquored him up for a week and showed him all the bands, and he went back and wrote his report. So basically what happened was kind of sold it to the British, who sold it back to us.
Right, yeah, exactly. Or Bruce Pavitt says, like, you know, that bands that looked or felt more authentically American, spirited but somewhat unmannered. And in fact, one of the things is, do you think that in some ways grunge might have been something that was the very first time kind of, I don't know, a certain different kind of ironic anger was attributed to some rock music, and that's one of the things that had never happened before, like a kind of a put-down kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of irony involved in it. I mean, yeah. Sub Pop in particular, they had the loser shirt, people kind of, you know, advertising that they were losers, or that they were less than, or that they were lame. Terms like that would come up quite a bit. You know, sort of a tongue-in-cheek approach to fame, which obviously eventually became a reality. But, you know, there was a real sense of humor to this scene, sometimes missed, because a lot of times we look back at Kurt Cobain and how obviously that story ended, how, you know, Layne Staley of Alice in Chains ended, you know, the sort of the fog of the heroin, but there was a lot of very, very funny people in that scene, and they actually continue to be very, very funny people.
And what about Nirvana going on to a major label? I mean, it wasn't really the shock that some people might have thought it was. I mean, it was kind of a standard thing in some ways. That's the next step.
Yeah, I don't think them going to a major label by that point, all sorts of bands were going to a major label. I think it was the level of success. I mean, they were, at the time, they were, you know, had cited that they would be happy with a Sonic Youth level of success, which I can't recall the figures. It was probably, Sonic Youth probably sold like 100,000, a couple 100,000 records. But, you know, they did not foresee going multi-platinum by any means, or the sort of level of success. So that was really where they kind of redefined the parameters, but it wasn't uncommon. I mean, there were you know, Jane's Addiction and Faith No More and other underground bands had already done the major label route. They just hadn't broken through to the mainstream to the same degree.
But the funny thing is, like, the fact that Sonic Youth wouldn't have necessarily sold millions of albums, it kind of kept their authenticity supposedly alive, which is ridiculous in some ways when you think about it. The music's either good or bad or whatever. But like, when Nirvana did go to where they went, would it be fair to say that this is exactly, the minute they got there, this is exactly what Kurt Cobain, basically he'd become what he'd been trying to avoid?
Right. I mean, I think Kurt Cobain, I mean, obviously never knew the man, but he's a little bit more complicated than some people. I mean, they did sign to a major label because they did want to be successful. There was that element of it. And he was a very, by all accounts, I mean, his manager told a story about how he would compare how, you know, how many plays Smells Like Teen Spirit got on MTV versus the Pearl Jam video. So he was, there was a competition there, certainly. You know, it was a very mixed reaction to their success and the media onslaught. So I don't think you can paint it either way. It was somewhere right down the middle.
The whinging irony that we mentioned earlier on, did Kurt Cobain kill punk?
Did he kill punk? I don't think anyone killed punk. I mean, punk still seems to be...
All right, well, let's put it this way then. I mean, like, without a doubt, the music that we're talking about here, the grunge thing, it changed US rock irrevocably, no question. For the better or for the worse?
It depends who you ask. I mean, certainly at the time it was for the better. I mean, in the wake of that, we got a lot of bands that's, you know, some might say like Nickelback or kind of a, you know, a couple of generations on. You could call them post-grunge, I suppose, and they're one of the more hated bands, at least here right now. I don't know how if you know Nickelback over there.
100%, and anybody who hates them, I think, is spot on, frankly. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, so, I mean, that could, in one way, be seen as what grunge wrought. So I don't know. I mean, I think it definitely encouraged a lot of kids to pick up guitars, and that's never a bad thing.
Sure, but like, I mean, let's go back to the Kurt Cobain not wanting what he actually got. Everybody wanted to sound like Nirvana, except Nirvana.
Right. I mean, you know, you mentioned that In Utero's anniversary is coming up, and that was definitely sort of that album was a sort of a step, I wouldn't say step back, but more to the sound. You know, Kurt Cobain famously complained about Nevermind sound as being too slick and like a Motley Crue record, and then this album was recorded by Steve Albini, who was, you know, kind of known for sort of a little bit harsher sounds, we'll say, and you know, this was the album, you know, after it came out, he commented on how this was the sound that he had always pictured. You know, Steve Albini had produced or recorded the Pixies, Breeders, PJ Harvey, bands like that.
Yeah, but like, I mean, like, you know, I'd rather hear Nevermind than Bleach. But I suppose if I was a real fan of the whole thing, I'm supposed to say Bleach, am I? Which was the first not as well produced album, and that's the whole point. Anyway, the city of Seattle, it got its own movie, which was shot before the word grunge was heard around the world, but it came out much later, Singles.
Right. Singles was that was actually a movie that, as you mentioned, that was filmed prior to the whole explosion. I mean, the members of Pearl Jam are in that movie, and this was before they were even
Mookie
called Pearl
Blaylock.
Jam. They were Mookie Blaylock at the time, and there's, you know, appearances from Soundgarden and Alice in Chains. I mean, it was actually the whole Seattle explosion. That movie was in the can for a while before it got released, and that was part of what helped get it released, was this grunge explosion. And then even that wasn't quite enough. They had to, you know, Cameron Crowe and his, you know, production team had to get agreements from Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and Alice in Chains to perform at this MTV party. At which Eddie Vedder famously got drunk and disorderly, and they had to get them there to even guarantee the film a wide release. So it wasn't an easy sell even after grunge exploded.
Everybody has a story of how Kurt Cobain met Courtney Love. Courtney doesn't necessarily, I mean, you don't judge in this book, but she doesn't necessarily come out of it too well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's open to interpretation, but she was kind enough to speak with me at great length, and you know, that you what you say is right. I mean, there is a lot of kind of vagueness and the fog of, I wouldn't say war, but surrounding you know, how she met Kurt and what's true and what's not. I mean, Courtney definitely has her own version of the truth, and you know, she, you know, has often been accused of being a liar and often has her own version of truth. I don't know what she believes and what she doesn't, but she's certainly opinionated about it, and you got to give her that.
Do you think a lot of people within the scene realize that there wasn't really a scene, or a lot of people within the scene realize that it's no different than anything else? Like, for instance, you know, this kind of outward thing of the blue-collar reputation that it all had. Shirley Temple's daughter was there. There was a jazz prodigy who played in the White House. There was a college graduate. It wasn't a scene.
Well, I mean, I think it was still a scene, but are you questioning the class that?
Well,
the
no,
class
I mean, I think you could go to Minneapolis for the Replacements and Husker Du. You could start saying there's a scene anywhere as long as there's two bands doing something that you know, jump a little bit past the mainstream or get somewhere. Now, I know that the Nevermind album changed so much and knocked Michael Jackson off the charts or whatever it was, all this kind of stuff. But by the same token, like, you know, it's not exactly Motown in Motown. It's not exactly Liverpool with the Beatles and all the bands that came afterwards.
There was certainly a scene that was not something that was fabricated. There were this handful of bands that were playing every weekend or every other weekend, and you know, there was definitely, you know, you look back in history and you see the Bills with Soundgarden and the Melvins all these bands were playing and knew each other. It was a scene in the truest sense that they were all very they were swapping members, they were all friends. I mean, that's something that should be emphasized. Yeah. These bands in general and were friends and still are friends. I mean, 20 years on, they're still, you know, they have families and they're still, you know, hanging out with each other and going drinking and things of that nature. So it was very tight-knit. And continues to be to this day.
Well, I did ask earlier, did grunge kill punk? Did grunge kill hair metal?
That's the grunge killing hair metal is a bit of a myth. I mean, hair metal was already in decline at that point. You know, grunge definitely replaced it on the radar screen for that time. And there was a lot of complaining from the hair metal crews, but you know, they certainly didn't affect the bigger bands, the Bon Jovis, people of that stature. And those bands, you know, a lot of those bands are, you know, Motley Crue's still around, so clearly they weren't killed off. It takes a lot to kill Motley Crue, as history has proven.
Absolutely. Okay, well, then, could the two have joined together? Because the story about Soundgarden and the possibility of touring with Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, I mean, Soundgarden did tour with Guns N' Roses, which wasn't probably the best fit for them, because you know, Axl Rose famously, you know, would start his shows 2 hours late, and you know, it was kind of a prima donna, which was pretty antithetical to if there was a grunge philosophy, which was kind of just get up on stage and play and not be prima donna about it. So that was, I mean, at the time it was also seen a bit as I don't know if selling out would be the right word, but you know, betraying their audience by playing with this metal act. And you know, Axl Rose famously wanted to invite Nirvana out, or had invited Nirvana on tour, but they kind of laughed that off.
Right. Well, like, I mean, you know, Beatles versus the Stones, the Pistols versus the Clash, Blur versus the Oasis, whatever. All that musical rivalry stuff. What are we talking about Seattle here? And are we still talking the word rivalry? Is it Nirvana versus Pearl Jam?
I mean, that was certainly at the time. I mean, it was a rivalry between Kurt and Eddie Vedder. There were words exchanged. I mean, it famously, you can see it in the Pearl Jam 20 movie, the footage of Kurt and Eddie Vedder dancing at the MTV Awards, kind of making up for their feud, as it were. I mean, I think at the time, I mean, I recall being a fan of, it was pick a camp.
Yeah.
It was, pick, are you with Nirvana, who were perceived as the more punk or alternative band, or were you with Pearl Jam, who were seen as the more corporate rock band? I mean, those distinctions seem a little silly now.
True, but by the same token, like, bands were actually moving to Seattle to get themselves signed, if you like. So there was a feeding frenzy which started in the wake of Nevermind from Nirvana, 10 from Pearl Jam, and it did seem to get kind of ridiculous, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, certainly the scene was ridiculous in that you know, people would talk about all these bands moving from, you know, especially L.A., which used to be an epicenter of rock where you would go to make it. People moving from L.A. to Seattle, you know, getting some Doc Martens and some thermal underwear and trying to make it. But, you know, outside of that, I mean, you know, Pearl Jam have their roots in, you know, Mother Love Bone and Malfunction, bands that were, you know, they were there since the beginning. I mean, Eddie Vedder was from San Diego. He came in from the outside. But they were pretty much as bona fide Seattle scenesters as anyone.
Okay, well, then let's take a look kind of towards the end of it all, I suppose, in some ways. I mean, like, I know this, we're talking the anniversary of In Utero as well, but the story of grunge, or the end of grunge, is inextricably tied up with heroin, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, certainly Kurt's death, which can be argued. I mean, some people point to that as the end of grunge. I mean, I don't think grunge has ended. I mean, three out of the four big grunge bands are still around. We still have Pearl Jam. Soundgarden have reunited. Alice in Chains have a new singer. I mean, even Nirvana have, you know, the surviving members have performed with Paul McCartney. Mm. So grunge is pretty alive and well. But heroin was kind of, yes, inextricably linked with Seattle and the Seattle scene. Some say unfairly, because, you know, that drug was available readily in many a city. And not everyone, clearly not everyone did it, but a lot of enough high-profile people, usually the lead singer of a band, did it, that it became, you know, sort of inextricably linked.
Well, as I say, you know, fame doesn't take away the pain, it just pays the bills. And, like, certainly for Kurt Cobain, like, he was so, like, miserable for so long. It has given an awful lot of darkness to how people view the whole grunge Seattle thing from the perspective 20 years later now, hasn't it? Do you think unfairly a bit?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, these are very, very funny people for the most part. Even Kurt Cobain and Lynn Staley, you know, who both met early demises, were universally described as being supremely, supremely funny, so with great senses of humor. You know, obviously they had their dark side and their addictions, but I think that the sense of humor and the irony is often overlooked, because, you know, the videos of that time, back when people watched videos where they were very dirty and well, for lack of a better word, grungy, and, you know, they had a certain aura that people interpreted as dark and dingy.
Okay, well, like the legacy and what's still there then. I mean, for instance, you know, Soundgarden playing here in Dublin this month, Pearl Jam, they kind of had surpassed grunge by a certain time. Like, when the backlash came, some people did survive and some didn't. Do you think Offspring, Green Day and that kind of thing brought it back into something that left grunge behind a bit and just be, you know, to be a chapter in history?
Well, I mean, bands like that certainly benefited from the success of grunge, the you know, mainstream of making the so-called alternative mainstream, and bands like Offspring and Green Day, obviously more in the, you know, in the punk pop punk tradition. But yeah, I mean, that was just the next thing, and then there was Britpop and electronica, and, you know, every, you know, trends move on. And grunge had kind of had its day. I mean, the bands that did survive were the bands that kind of transcended that label in a way, that became just pop bands like Pearl Jam and Soundgarden.
Well, Pearl Jam have a new album next month, as I say, Soundgarden here. Alice in Chains, a new album a few months ago. Mudhoney, a new album a few months ago. Melvins just toured in honour of the 30th anniversary. By the way, Bleach, Nevermind, In Utero, now that we're looking at In Utero, which would be your favourite album of those?
I kind of do like Bleach. I mean, I listened to a lot of grunge while I was writing the book, and Bleach, you know, grew on me. Certainly, I think Nevermind was just, I've heard those songs so many times. Yeah. It's probably just from overhearing it. In Utero certainly is a great album, and And but I don't know, Bleach just for me just, I mean, and it's not just because it was their first and independent album, but something about its unvarnished nature I like a lot. And you can see, I mean, the songwriting was there from an early.
And by the way, the guy who paid for that album supposedly is the guy who, let me get this right, because the story was in the papers recently that he's some kind of is he in the American Army mercenary SAS or something, and he was also in Soundgarden and he was also in Nirvana.
Yeah, his name is Jason Everman, who actually I did interview for the book. He lives here in Brooklyn, actually. And I met up with him, and he had a long storied history. He was basically, depending on who you ask, kicked out of or both Nirvana and Soundgarden.
Yeah.
So he was basically had that dubious distinction of being in two very prominent bands and then getting kicked out. And then he went on to be in the Special Forces, so he was in Afghanistan. Perhaps Iraq. I don't remember the exact things. He's pretty mum on the details of that, but you know, he was described as being a war hero.
Sure, so, for good reasons. All right.
And now he's a philosopher. You know, he studied philosophy at Columbia University. Yeah. So he's had a very varied career.
All right, well, listen, thank you very much indeed, Mark, for talking to us. Just take a look again. The Tumblr blog is Grunge Book. The book we're talking about here is Everybody Loves Our Town. To give it the full title, Everybody Loves Our Town, A History of Grunge. Mark Yarm, thanks very much for talking to us, Mark.
Thank you so much, Dave. I really appreciate it.
Good man.